Hello there, and welcome to the Johnny Fallon podcast referendum series, where we take an in-depth look at some of the major referendums that have helped to shape discussion, debate, and policy in modern Ireland. Our written constitution gives us many protections and advantages, but also brings with it quite a few political headaches. So how do we face these issues, and how have they changed over time? Well, that's what we want to find out, and this week we go back to 1987 and the Single European Act. So if you have some time to kill, join me as we discuss a referendum that changes Ireland's relationship with Europe forever. Well, it's great to be back with another podcast on another really interesting referendum from Ireland's modern history. Now, coming to a subject like the Single European Act might not sound like the most exciting thing in the world to start off, but it is. It comes at a crucial juncture in Ireland's history, and it does change so much about what happens. There are also developments in this that, of course, change referendums forever in Ireland, particularly referendums around European issues. So I suppose one of the best places to start here is just to try and cast your mind back. Maybe you've listened to the episode we did on Ireland's entry to the EEC in 1972 and that referendum and all that went with it. You don't have to have listened to it, but if you have, you'll have a good sense of exactly where Ireland's head was at in terms of joining the EU, EEC as it was then, what would eventually become the EU. And a step on the way to becoming the EU is this Single European Act. But it's worth just considering what's happened in Ireland, because we're in 1987 now, as opposed to 1972, and Ireland has seen dramatic changes. It's seen a lot of upheaval. It's seen a lot of political upheaval. Europe has just been there in the background. But one thing is quite clear. Over that time, some of those prophets of doom, if you like, in 1972 that we discussed and looked at, they've had a tough time in this intervening period, because a lot of those, you know, those promises of everything being destroyed and jobs being destroyed and everything were not coming true. Now, Ireland was not exactly booming here, but probably one of what people saw as the only bright lights in what had happened in those intervening years was the interaction with Europe and the positive economic benefits that that was bringing to people. So Europe was getting some good PR here over those years, and it was seen as something where, at least locally, I suppose in Ireland, people felt, well, if our own governments aren't delivering, at least there does seem to be this really positive interaction with Europe and jobs and all of that sense. But there was a sense that Europe was a good thing, and it turned out to be a good thing, and Ireland was gradually trying to modernise, even if it was struggling with things itself here at home. So that sounds good. You think Europe, Ireland, marriage made in heaven, if you like, all good. Then we come to the Single European Act. And why does it happen in the first place? Well, the Single European Act, without getting too technical on it, and you could spend hours looking at a topic like this in terms of the detail and the legal details of what was going on at Europe and so on. But essentially, after the EEC had been formed, of course, this was a common trade area. That was the aim of it, that, you know, you could have good free trade between all of the member states. The reality was, though, that it wasn't quite working out like that, because when you get a club of countries together, there are certain products that countries protect, and so many little areas and fiefdoms that countries are looking after. They looked at this and said, effectively, we don't have what you would call real, absolute free trade. And the only way you're going to get absolute free trade is if you treat it all as one market, a single market. And the leaders wanted and attempted to try bring together some of the issues. There were issues around voting. There were always issues. And one of the things this proves to us in the Single European Act is just how complex and complicated it is to do something like this, to create something like the European Union. It's phenomenally complicated. And the amount of hours and diplomacy and debate that go into this is just endless. But they have had the EEC running quite well, but it doesn't deliver the kind of benefits that Europe really, really needs, particularly as they're watching a more and more globalised world begin to take shape, where travel and communications and everything by this stage are on a global scale. And Europe needs to transform itself, and it needs to have this proper internal market. However, the internal market, as regards that, isn't as simple as just saying, look, no trade and tariffs on anything, and you're all happy out, just off you go. It brings with it a lot of issues. Once you have member states there, there's also going to be a problem called cohesion, which is that you have all these member states in there. How are you going to ensure that it is all one, treated as one area, and they're all able to compete? If you think about this for a minute, I mean, Ireland, the Republic of Ireland here, is a single market for all the counties. Now imagine if that was being brought together from every county having its own trade tariffs with other counties, protecting their own industries, and you're trying to bring it all together. How long it would take for each of those counties to agree on different things and different elements. And you're effectively only going to have proper free trade and movement and create a united market if you're able to get them all to just agree on that and agree to take away these every barrier and all these protections they've got. But that's going to be complex. And that's what's happening here. Europe knows and understands, look, to be a truly effective bloc, we need to greatly change here. But in that change, we then have to bring in cohesion. With cohesion comes this idea that how do you take the poorest areas, the less well-off areas, and ensure that they are going to be okay with this, that they are going to be able to compete in the markets. But that's not charity, by the way. That comes from a very deep understanding, which is one of the things the European Union's good at. It's not fast. It doesn't take quick decisions. It does study things in enormous depth, and that allows them time and space sometimes to come to a greater appreciation of some very long-term things. One of which is, there's no point opening up a market and allowing trade if you're a rich country and you're trying to trade with regions that are far, far poorer and can't afford the products you're making. You need them to reach a certain level of wealth in order to be able to buy the products that you're producing or your country's producing. And that means you need them to improve their economic circumstances. So it's not a charity thing. It's makes good sense. It's transfers of wealth with an ultimate aim that trade benefits and companies benefit. And that's where Europe's at. So it's facing this thing of, it's got, needs to change into a proper functioning market where the rules work and the vision of the old EEC is actually able to work. But it is also going to face great inequalities within that. So it's going to introduce this idea of cohesion. And it's that idea of cohesion that's going to change Ireland. Because with that comes these things like funds and money and everything else that's going to hugely, hugely impact Ireland. We're going to be returning to them time and time again. But for now, it's here that that theory starts to come in. And it's going to change Ireland's interaction with Europe and our negotiations with Europe and how we see Europe. But at this point, Europe comes up and goes through a lot of painful negotiations in order to get to this point and in order to develop an act that gives a basis. Now, they knew there was going to be further treaties needed, there were further steps needed, but this was the one that was going to set them on a journey towards this absolute single market where consumers can buy things freely and companies can operate freely and people can move freely. And that's their aim with the Single European Act. Now, as I say, though, Ireland has been doing quite well just in terms of its relationship with Europe. And it's been, it's since it's got in there for a small country who decided, well, we have to get into this EEC thing because Britain was going in as well. It would be disastrous. They were in and we were out and so on and so forth. But it did bring challenges with us. And as we saw in that referendum campaign on entry, there were some very big fears about Ireland being part of this. However, they have played a very smart game. And one of the things that becomes apparent, and I personally think always becomes apparent, is there's a nature to Irish politics that we've discussed before in election series and other podcasts. There's a nature in Irish politics that is very much because of our multi-party system, because of our constituency approach. There's that what we sometimes criticise as our parochial approach within our politicians. Leads to a certain style, though, of continual ongoing negotiation that they have to do, just keeping one step ahead of the game. It's our political system gives us this. And our civil servants are particularly strong in terms of handling governments that have to change and politicians that come and go and various different types of people that brings into politics. Our civil servants are very good at handling that and reading it. And our politicians are very good at what might be described as the backroom stuff of politics, because they exist continually in back rooms and small places where you're kind of saying, well, what deal do I need to do today? That's the nature of Irish politics. It's always about deal making in some way, shape or form, because you never seem to have a clear cut, safe seat, majority, any of those things. And the reason I point that out is that over time that's led to Ireland really performing very well in Europe when it comes to cutting deals and doing negotiations and being very smart about it, how it plays that game. And it just weirdly turns out Ireland is very good at European politics. I'm very smart about how it plays it. Now, just to give you a sense, though, of this picture and where it was at for Ireland, turning to Gareth Fitzgerald in his book Reflections on the Irish State, where he describes kind of where it was at with Ireland up to this point. And he says, quote, when, in the mid-1980s, the scale of the EC's milk surplus led to a decision to impose a system of milk quotas due to the support of German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and the active advocacy of President Mitterrand, both very friendly to Ireland, Ireland's exceptional dependence on this farm sector was recognised by according to it a bonus of 1/8 additional quota. Meanwhile, Ireland was securing a disproportionate share of the newly established social fund for its expanding training programmes, receiving up to 13% of the fund at one stage, although its population was only 1% of that of the EC. And when the regional fund was finally established in 1974, I negotiated for Ireland 6.5% rather than the proposed 3.5% of the resources available. A negotiation that ensured that Ireland was the only member country to preserve its original allocation when the resources finally allocated to that fund were virtually halved following the first oil crisis. Ireland also secured the consent of the European Commission to replace its export tax exemption, banned by the European Commission as discriminating in favour of home production, with a tax of only 10% on all industrial profits. Given the very high level of corporate taxes in all other EU states, this proved an immensely valuable in attracting to Ireland industrial investments from outside the EC, notably from the United States. By the 1990s, this low tax was helping Ireland to attract 1/4 of the number of all new US industrial investments in Western Europe, although not necessarily 1/4 of the volume of such activity. These were remarkable achievements for a new member state, and they created a highly favourable public climate in Ireland towards the community. However, successive governments, including those in which I participated, were content to allow the popularity of EC membership to rest exclusively on these economic benefits that Ireland was receiving, without seeking to deepen Irish attachment to the community by reference to its positive roles in creating a zone of peace in Western Europe and in leading the global development aid process. There has never been adequate appreciation in Ireland of Europe's remarkable achievements in these and other respects during the decades after the Second World War. By 1945, Europe's infrastructure had been largely destroyed. The economies of most of its states were in grave difficulties, and its peoples were threatened with hunger in 1947. Overnight, the continent that had for so long held world leadership had lost this role with the emergence onto the world stage of two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. No one could then have foreseen the way this battered, demoralized continent would succeed in the decades that followed in reversing the tide of its history by initiating four major intellectual revolutions that ultimately transformed its role in global affairs. End quote. That's from Gareth Fitzgerald, Reflections on the Irish State, and looking at the impact Ireland was having in Europe and the impact of its role within the European economic community in terms of what it was able to do in negotiations. And within that book, he also gives a very good description. I'm not going to go into it right now, but a very good description of some of the things that were going on and the debates that were happening within Europe, as regards voting systems and everything else. But what he points to there are two things. First of all, just to step back and take Europe here, because he makes a very important point that's crucial to understanding the Single European Act and where it was coming from and why it was important for Ireland. There is a bigger picture here. Now, perhaps it's a little bit easier now it is for us maybe to grasp than maybe it was for some people in 1987, because as I record this, we're in the middle of a COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic, and economies have been shut down, and people are highly aware of the impact of something like that global shutdown on economies, on trade, on countries trying to get, we can't travel, we can't go to other countries, we can't get out and do the things we'd normally do. All of that has had a huge life-limiting effect on people, and we're acutely aware now of the impact of that on our economy. Now, let's just cast our minds back to where the European economic community has been born out of, as Gareth Fitzgerald mentions there, the aftermath of World War II. And look, let's be honest here. If we think what we've got here with COVID-19 and coronavirus is a huge problem for our economies, and it is, but it's nothing compared to where Europe was in the 40s. This is a continent that has been utterly dominant in world affairs. Utterly dominant since the dawn of time. It has managed to come out, and time again, the peoples and countries of Europe have been at the forefront of everything that's been happening. And that has led them to get to these superpower status within Europe, that each of these countries, the French, the British, the Germans, they have empires. They've had empires going back to the Greeks and Romans. This is just something Europe has had and not been accustomed to forever. And it has culminated in these powers clashing time and time again. But ultimately, they're clashing fatally in World War One and World War Two, and they're not getting out of this. They're not getting out of this unscathed this time. They're going to come out of the whole Second World War devastated as a continent. The United States has for two war. I mean, you got to remember, the United States has effectively only been born out of Napoleon handing them over a big wad of land for a couple of million to us. He's funding his war efforts and he's saying, look, I can't really take all that land in the US, even though France has claimed to it, so I'm giving it to the US in the hope that the US is going to end up fighting Britain, which they do, and all of that's going to be great for me. Doesn't work out great for him, but you know, in the long term history, he, I suppose, gets some wish here. But that's only a short hop in history terms away. And suddenly, by the end of World War II, the United States and Russia are the two big powers. The Soviet Union has now going to take up that communist ideal, the big ideological battles after that. And Europe has just bombed, shot and murdered itself into oblivion. It would have been fair for people to think that Europe was never again going to rise to any kind of power after that. The fact is that the EEC and the formulation of the EEC as it becomes transforms Europe and does lead to what has been a quite unbelievable turnaround, that it is now again a major player in world affairs, from where it might have just been a whole load of also ran little countries insignificant in anything else that was going on. And sometimes that's not appreciated, and Fitzgerald points it out there, that when we talk about this in Ireland, and in Ireland at this point, successive governments talk about, listen, why should we be in Europe? The money, lads. The money. They keep giving us money and there's economic benefits and that's what it's about. Europe, this was about something much bigger. But that never actually gets down to the referendums, the debates, the discussion. What is Europe? What are we part of Europe? That's not happening. The good stuff Europe was doing as this matter of peace, of bringing countries together, of actually saying, listen, we cannot afford to be also rans in the world. We have got to come together and work this. That never becomes part of that vision of Europe in the likes of Ireland. That debate isn't had. It's just about, well, what can they do for us? Will they get us a bit more? Will we get a bit wealthier because of it? That's where debate tends to centre. Now, for the Europeans, at a high level, as some might say the elites level, they are thinking about this. They are trying to get Europe going again. And the Single European Act is bound out of that, that they've come so far, but they realise to really be there, they have to become this big market. The United States and the Soviet Union are enormous markets. And in the same way, in the modern world today, we might say, well, Soviet Union are gone, but you look at China and it's such a big, huge, enormous country of people, of market. The day was gone when you were a big country with 60, 70 million people. Now we're talking about countries with markets with hundreds of millions of people. And you need to be able to create that, a billion people, you know. How do you get those kind of numbers in? Because that's what drives the success of an economy and of a market and the ability and purchasing power of countries. So Europe is trying to adapt to that reality. But also remember, that when I say this was a success and people say, oh, well, you know, was it that successful? Had they a choice? Part of the reason those negotiations are so tough, and it's so tough coming to the Single European Act, is because these are countries that have spent centuries invading and attacking and putting one over on one another and rivaling each other and disliking each other and everything else. And now they're expected to be talking about cohesion, helping those poorer countries over there, giving some of our money away to them who'll then come up and they'll buy our products. This is a very complex economic argument here. Lost in the times of history where, you know, we've just been used to don't want their goods and services, hate that country, hate them as well, don't like them. Their guys are all right, we'll ally with them and we'll kick the other guy's ass over there. That's how this has always been done. Now it's into, you know, we're certainly all working together in a very short period of time. You know, from the aftermath of World War II to 1987, when they talk about this Single European Act, is an incredibly short period of time to be trying to overcome those internal difficulties, rivalries and debates. So it becomes this essential thing for Europe in order to allow them develop and in order to allow them succeed. But it's not all going to go easily to plan, because there's a huge amount of negotiation that has to be go behind this idea of a single market. You can't just have it. It's not just the trade and tariffs and everything else. And Ireland is playing a key role in that, because Ireland is one of the countries that is poor and it's on the periphery. And Ireland is saying, hey, you can't just, you know, make rules that are going to benefit big countries. You've got to remember that there's fairness here for the small countries. And Ireland is lucky because, as I say, Europe at a commission level isn't into, you know, just doing things. The Commission's job is actually put long, slow, ponderous thought. It doesn't make them good in a crisis, but it does in terms of these policy things, get them thinking about things. And the Commission's quite favourable to Ireland's, because the Commission can see this. It can see that, you know, yeah, there is no point in doing this if countries just get swept aside and, you know, lost in it or can't compete in it, because then they just can't buy the products and the whole thing is just going to fall apart. Therefore, Ireland has a strong ally in the Commission, but it's got to get that view across through all of these difficult national governments as well, who have in turn in their own democracies problems with how their people see what's going on. And that's repeated, and we'll see it repeated in European referendums time and time again. And if you want to understand Europe and the level of negotiation that goes on and Ireland's role in that and, you know, what happens within Europe, then I have to say I recommend a book called Behind Closed Doors, The EU Negotiations That Shaped Modern Ireland by Dr. Peter Brennan. And it's a complicated story. It's a very scientific read, if you like, but I recommend it because sometimes we think of this, and it's easy in Ireland, you know, we think about referendums, all of that, that we just push these things off a little bit. You know, it's not that big a deal. It's not, you know, major. Surely, how hard can it be? Get them in a room. These things take years. And the amount of hurdles that they have to overcome are enormous. But what is really important here is this idea begins to come on that you can't have, you know, the single European Act is going to be about cohesion. Now, cohesion is going to shape, cohesion funds and all that is going to shape how Europe reacts for a very long time to a lot of issues and become central to Ireland's relationship with it. And to turn to Peter Brennan in his book Behind Closed Doors and give you a sense of this, he says, quote, "For several years in the early 1980s, there were unsuccessful attempts to make progress towards closer integration within the European community. The solemn declaration on the European Union adopted at the Stuttgart summit in June 1983 made limited progress. However, once the budgetary and other problems which had so deeply divided the community were settled by the Fontainebleau European Council in June 1984, the European Council decided to set up an ad hoc committee for institutional affairs, which reported to the European Council in Milan on the 28th, 29th of June 1985. This committee, the emphasis of this committee was on the promotion of economic convergence rather than cohesion, which has not yet been articulated as a policy concept. The European Parliament's draft proposals for a treaty, which were submitted to the Council in February 1984, related to regional policy, but did not make any reference to cohesion. The adoption by the Commission in 1985 of its internal market programme gave the negotiations a spur, as did the accession of Greece and the pending accession of Spain and Portugal, which increased the existing disparities in average living standards." End quote. Now, that's important. It's important to understand because Europe is looking at this single European Act. As we approach it, Europe's trying to deal with these problems and it's trying to, and cohesion becomes this big issue in the background of that. Ireland has been fighting this case and trying to fight its case here on this. The accession of these other countries that are coming in, though, plays a big role too. These are also weaker economic entities, and they have to be helped, and they're going to have that the disparities are going to be even greater there. So that gives a certain emphasis on what has to happen here. Just returning to Peter Brennan and his book Behind Closed Doors again, to discuss here just what the Commission thought of the policy and how you give this money around or enable these transfers. And he says, quote, "In the Commission's view, policy measures may attempt to solve regional problems by social income transfers from stronger to weaker regions. But such policies can have no more than a temporary effect on the income-generating capacity of the weaker regions of the community. These regions must also, aided as appropriate by national and community policy measures, achieve levels of economic development at which they will be capable of producing goods and services which can be sold in a situation of ever-increasing competition. This criterion is a necessary precondition for assuring self-sustained regional development. The first description of a key aim of a cohesion policy was thus articulated." End quote. Now, again, that's important, and I want to touch on that here in the context of this referendum, because this is all important in this changing nature. This is not going to be, weirdly enough, the central point of the referendum itself, but it is a central point of where the politicians are thinking, because this is why this is all so important. Cohesion policy is being articulated here. And I think that paragraph is so important, because it's so important in perhaps understanding something that, because we don't debate it in the referendums, it gets hugely misunderstood, perhaps by a lot of Irish voters. You can see the commission there saying, look, we can have these transfers. That's fine. They do a role, but they are a temporary role. What's got to happen here is that they increase the wealth, and that's good for richer countries, because these poorer countries need to, you know, buy the products and services and get to a standard where they can afford them. But ultimately, those poorer countries need to reach a standard where then they are producing goods and services and they are selling them on. That's how this has got to work. That's the only sustainable way of doing this. And of course, you know, we're pausing at this point, because just to think of that, Ireland, if you look now and we step out of our focus in on the Single European Act of 87 and where Ireland is now, and why Europe and its interaction with Ireland, when we come to later treaties, we're going to discuss this in depth. And it's important now in that context to make this marker now. That's how the European Commission sees this working. Give you the transfers, you got to get good, we all help, and then you get money, and then you're sustainable and successful. If there's a poster boy of this policy working, it's Ireland. The difference from 1987 to, you know, 1997, 2007, even in the aftermath of financial crisis and so on, the difference in what you're looking at in a transformation of an economy from Ireland at that point to what Ireland becomes is just enormous. And that's why they believe, and Europeans will believe, look, this is the poster boy. This is how this policy was meant to work, and it worked exactly. The Irish was a poor peripheral economy that couldn't really afford the products and services being bought and produced and done. We helped them, we gave the transfers, we do everything. Ireland suddenly is able to do that. It becomes an important market even for some of these products from Europe. And then Ireland begins to also produce stuff that goes out and can become a net contributor to the EU in order to further increase the size of this market to compete internationally. And that's what this is all about. So that makes enormous sense at this point. Back, however, to 1987 and back to what was actually happening in terms of Ireland's role in this. Peter Brennan, I turn to again in his book Behind Closed Doors. Quote, in the decade after membership, Ireland, almost single-handedly, but with much sympathy from the Commission, fought the good fight for a fair deal to reflect the country's poor standard of living when compared to other member states. The policies agreed during this period, most importantly the link between EMU and the need to address the needs of the less developed regions, the idea of concentration of resources and preparation of regional development plans, were the building blocks upon which more developed policy on cohesion was based in the context of the Delors I reforms. End quote. Now, a couple of things there. What he's talking about there, those policies, the regional development plans, economic and monetary union, being about how you can't have economic and monetary union unless you've got this cohesion policy. All of those links are crucially important to how Europe and the direction of it. And Ireland is at the very heart of that process and has been for even longer than it's getting support from the other countries coming in. But Ireland's been the one here helping to shape and make this. And when he mentions there the Delors I package, we'll cover that at a later stage in the referendum. Once the Single European Act comes in, we then have to get into how we actually do all this and how that money's going to be there. And Jacques Delors leads this negotiations, which are painful. We will go into it later, but painful negotiations on how much and what do you need and what do you get. Fascinating stuff. But all of that leads us to this referendum campaign where we're at. But pause, because we didn't actually think that this might end up in a referendum campaign. Remember, despite where we're at today, this is 1987. We have agreed to go into the EU. And, you know, that was fine. What more do you need from that? Decisions can be taken by the government, surely, at that point. Now, there were other European countries going through problems, and give you some insight into where the international debate that might have been influencing some of the situations was at. You had a situation where, in Denmark, they felt that this was giving as part of all this, there's new voting arrangements. They want to give more power to the European Parliament. They've introduced this qualified majority voting so as they can help to take decisions and get decisions. You know, you have to pass so many tests, complex system, but, you know, you get this qualified majority voting rather than just everything being straight out veto of countries, which is good. It's positive too. But it has all of these institutional reforms to allow this common market actually work and take decisions. Of course, the Danes look at this and go, we're not too sure about this European Parliament having all of this power. Because, you know, look, that may be reducing our power and qualified majority voting. And, you know, that points to an interesting debate here, which I'm just going to digress for a second, because it's one that fascinates me about Europe and about European referendums. You know, this thing we always get, and it'll always be said, there's a democratic deficit. And you see, that's one of those throwaway lines. And sometimes it bugs me about it because it's throw. And you kind of say to them, well, what do you mean by the democratic deficit? Because you can't say a line like that unless you have a very clear vision of what is the European Union you envisage happening. Because at its most simple, there are, let's say, there are many types of Europes you could have, but of the two most familiar are, is Europe a club of nations who come together to help each other out? Or is Europe a state, a super state? One government, one state. And the weird thing I find about that is that the people sometimes who shout loudest about the democratic deficit are the ones who then go, but I don't want a super state. And these are the kind of things that we don't get into discussing in referendums, and we don't get into detail on. Because here's the deal. If you give, and this is the kind of thing that was upsetting some of the people in Denmark, not all, there are various different reasons for going against it, but for some, it's the future of this. At the moment, what the Europe in at this point looks like is everybody goes out, we vote, we elect our national parliaments. Our national parliaments then have a government. That government then meets with other European governments and does whatever deals, but our government represents us there at that and comes back, and that's how it works. That gives our government control, and there are certain areas you can have a veto on, there are certain areas you can walk out on, there are certain areas you negotiate on, and certain areas you compromise on, and you have to come back and explain that to your people, and then they decide you did a good job or a bad job, and they elect your sack or whatever at the next election. That's the Club of Nations approach. Your government has the power. You have a council of ministers. And one of the things that happens here is, of course, that we never get into how laws are formed, and we think the European Commission just makes up laws and then imposes them. They don't. They have to be signed off by the Council of Ministers. So if it's an environmental law, your Minister for the Environment is sitting at that Council of Ministers signing off on that law. It's not imposed directly by Europe. Of course, your government has had input into it. However, when we don't get Europe, we kind of get this sense of, well, what should it be? Now, the other option is that you turn around and say, well, okay, we don't feel we connect with the Commission. We don't feel that they're out there. We feel that governments are going out. So we need more democratic control. Reduce the democratic deficit. And the best way to do that is, you know, well, let's look at the European Parliament. Has it got the power? We want to elect the people who have the power to make these decisions. The more you do that, then the more you require a body like the European Parliament to have ultimate power rather than a council of ministers, a heads of state or government. And if you do that, that's fine, but now you're electing people directly to a European Parliament. That is the step towards then a European government. And if you have a European government, then national governments are not so important after all, are they? You're on your way to a European state. That's the kind of tightrope Europe walks all the time. And it's complicated. And it's complicated because you are balancing powers between different institutions and differing views of what Europe should look like. And sometimes I think, you know, we throw around phrases about what's it without really appreciating who is doing what and what do we want it to be. Because mucking around with powers of bodies always can create unintended consequences and problems. Anyway, I digress, but I think it's an important point here. These are the things, again, we're not getting into discussing in this most crucial of referendums. Like a lot of things, we're just going to stick to, you know, economic, how much moolah is in this. But despite that, you have this kind of situation in Denmark where, you know, they're afraid we're giving the European Parliament too much powers here, and the Parliament votes, their own national Parliament votes down the referendum. The government decides, hold on, this is a disaster for Denmark, you know, now everybody's looking at us, and the government says the people will back us. They hold a voluntary referendum to overthrow that decision by the Parliament, and it's successful, and the Danish people back it and go, oh no, we still want to be part of Europe. We get it. And that is helpful for them. So they get over it. Meanwhile, over in Italy, they're having issues, but their issues are the exact opposite. They don't believe that we've given the European Parliament enough powers. And that's where the headaches come for Europe. You get all this, you get it, you knock heads together in a room, you get, and then they've all got to get back to their individual countries, and they've got a differing pressures and powers going on. All of that debate was going to make it difficult, but they're going to get over it in the other countries. Meanwhile, Ireland is there. Look, Ireland, you can imagine in Europe there would be a sense of you've done well out of this. You know, you're doing okay out of European EEC membership. Surely that's been proven to you. All those fears you had in 1972 haven't come true, have they? No. Your government's delighted. We want more. We want to be better part of this. And you know what? In the background is coming this big idea of cohesion. Cohesion funding, the single market. This could be massively beneficial to a poor region like Ireland. Ergo, politicians here are happy and they are ready to kind of make a move on this. Now, not in all ways, and I'm going to talk to some of the topics, and Fianna Fáil in particular, under Charles Haughey, do some backtracking and double talking here. But first of all, let's just deal with some of what happens in the referendum, because a very important thing occurs at this point, which is that Ireland expects, we just pass a vote in Oireachtas and off we go. It's not going to be that simple for them. It's going to be a lot more complex. I'm going to turn to Jane O'Mahony in her paper, Ireland's EU Referendum Experience. And Jane says, quote, by the time of the signature of the Single European Act in 1986, the consensus among political and legal circles was that parliamentary approval was sufficient in order for Ireland to ratify the new treaty. After a period of delay, the Single European Act was put before the Dáil on the 9th of December 1986. However, concern in certain legal and academic circles as to the means used to ratify the Single European Act was growing, and just before Christmas 1986, development economist and anti-EEC campaigner Raymond Crotty, backed by a larger group, challenged the constitutionality of the bill in the courts. Crotty and fellow campaigner Anthony Coughlan believed that the Single European Act went far beyond what the Irish people consented to when they originally approved membership of the EEC in 1972. On appeal to the Supreme Court in early 1987, Crotty succeeded in stopping the Oireachtas from ratifying the Single European Act. Basing its judgments on the provisions in Title 3 of the Single European Act entitled European Political Cooperation, by a 3-2 majority, the Supreme Court held that Title 3 was inconsistent with the Constitution, as it was additional to the original constitutional sanction provided by the 1972 referendum, and thus the Constitution required amendment if the Single European Act was to be ratified. The government moved quickly to approve legislation which would enable the Constitution to be amended, setting the stage for another EU-related referendum in 1987. As in 1972, the decision was taken to confine the 1987 referendum to a specific issue at hand, namely the amendment of the Constitution in order to ratify the Single European Act, rather than introducing an all-encompassing amendment that would make all future referendums unnecessary. This political decision has meant that since 1987, ratification of EU integration treaties in Ireland has been carried out by referendum. End quote. Now, there's a really important point within that, because this is like a grenade, really, that's landed into government at this point. It's a really difficult one. We thought this was going to be passed, and everybody and legals and everything for a long time said, you know, it's grand. So you can pass this within the Dáil. No, you can't. And Crotty decision affects this hugely. Goes to court, says, actually, this goes a little bit further than what's in there. Now, really importantly, here's one of these things where you talk about gambling and what you do and decisions you take. The government is forced to say, okay, right, we're going to have a referendum, and they've a choice. We could have put an amendment to the Constitution which takes out the need for doing this and says, you know, look, these things are, you know, held by the Parliament, whatever. Instead, they decide, no, we'll just hold a referendum about the Single European Act line that has to go in. So we will amend the Constitution to allow provisions of the Single European Act to be implemented, rather than to amend the Constitution to allow provisions of decisions taken at Europe or whatever, to go with European treaties, whatever. We don't go with a general one. Now, that's probably because the government gets a bit scared. I mean, this is, by the time this referendum comes up, Haughey, and I'll cover his backtrack on certain issues in this, which place him in a difficult position. But Haughey is leading a minority Fianna Fáil government. They've come to power. They've been, you know, got a great election result, but not quite an overall majority. They want to deal with this quickly. This is suddenly, oh, we're going to have a referendum. That's a little bit tricky. They don't want to give any more ammunition to these anti-campaigners. So they decide, look, keep it to this. If we go for something more overarching, they might say, oh, you're removing this forevermore from Ireland, this brilliant protection, yada, yada. So they decide to go with just this. And that's what the referendum comes about. Now, the question is, that's always on people's minds, is what if Haughey had said, let's go for it. Let's take this out. Let's have a referendum and say this decision now has created an anomaly that shouldn't be there. We shouldn't have to have all these referendums. Very complex issues, yada, yada, argued it. Could Haughey, with Fianna Fáil on the kind of support it was on in 87, the Fine Gael backing them, and the general kind of sense, could they have just about got that over the line? Given the referendum results, you'd kind of think there was a potential they could have, and maybe ended the need for all these European referendums after. That would have been one big political move. Doesn't happen, though. So one of those big what-ifs. They decide, let's keep it curtailed to this Single European Act. Anything else, future people's problem. Let them deal with that. And therefore, we're on the road now to a referendum on Europe again. And that's interesting, because it has changed now from the 1972. Where are you at? Where's Ireland at? Where are people at? What are they thinking about this? They've been very eager about it. We believe they're supportive of it. But, you know, people get scared, and people can get scared very easily by this kind of stuff. So it's one of those things, those situations where people are going to say, "What? It's a referendum on Europe," as many people see it. And going back to a quote from a piece here by Stephen Collins in an article he wrote in the Irish Times, looking back at the release of records from around the time. And he talks about Charles Haughey's reaction to this. So this is from Stephen Collins in the Irish Times. Quote, Taoiseach Charles Haughey was forced to engage in an urgent round of phone calls with European leaders in spring 1987 to explain why Ireland could not ratify the Single European Act, thereby putting the creation of the single market at risk. Just a month after he began his third term as Taoiseach in March 1987, Haughey was shocked by a Supreme Court decision that forced him to hold a referendum on the Single European Act. Government Press Secretary PJ Mara told political correspondents how he was furious at the decision of the court, arrived at by a 3-2 majority, which he believed to be perverse. The case had been taken by economist and campaigner Raymond Crotty, who had argued that the provisions in the Single European Act would impinge on Ireland's neutrality and erode sovereignty in a way not envisaged when Ireland joined the EEC in 1972. Just a few months earlier, in opposition in 1986, Haughey had demanded a referendum and encouraged the legal challenge. But now he faced a serious political crisis on Europe in tandem with the battle he faced to cope with the public finances. The Department of Foreign Affairs archives reveal how he spoke to President François Mitterrand of France the day after the court decision was announced on April 9th. "I was present on the afternoon of April 10th when the Taoiseach talked to President Mitterrand," wrote Foreign Affairs official David Donoghue. "The Taoiseach, speaking on the lines of an earlier conversation with Prime Minister Martens of Belgium, said that he regretted the development, over which he had no control, and that he hoped everything would be in order before the European Council meeting at the end of June. The French president was very courteous and understanding, and there was a particularly amicable exchange," recorded the official. The following morning, Donoghue went to the Taoiseach's home in Consili to be on standby in the event of a phone conversation materialising with Helmut Kohl of West Germany. In the event, one of the Chancellor's officials rang at the appointed time, and as he spoke English, the Taoiseach spoke to him without my assistance. From what I gathered from the Taoiseach subsequently, the official had been asked by the Chancellor to take a message to the Taoiseach. "Though I was not present during the conversation, my impression was that the Taoiseach spoke to the official very much along the lines of the earlier conversations with other heads of state and government. There was not particular suggestion from the Taoiseach afterwards that a follow-up conversation with the Chancellor was personally called for." The Dáil was recalled during the Easter break to pass a bill providing for a referendum on the Single European Act on May 26th. During the referendum campaign, there were reports that some other European governments were annoyed at the prospect that the Single European Act might be blocked by Ireland, despite the fact that it was signed by all other member states. Just days before the referendum, the German economic minister, Martin Bangemann, was reported as telling Irish industry minister Albert Reynolds that there would be harmful consequences for this country if the Single European Act was not ratified. The German government officially denied the report, but it was widely believed to be true. In the event the Single European Act was passed by a massive majority, with 70% voting yes, but the court decision resulted in a number of subsequent referendums on EU treaties, two of which were defeated before being run a second time. The archives reveal the government spent €202,417 on media advertising calling for a yes vote in the referendum. End quote. That was from Stephen Collins, just looking back at the historical archives when they were released around this time, for the details of this time in negotiations. But look, there's an important point there too. First of all, Haughey has been a bit duplicitous in this. In opposition, and again, those of you who've been part of this journey on the election series and all know that what Haughey was asked in the run-up to 1987 was all-out opposition. Opposition on everything. This is complete, total opposition. So you hit them on everything. And one of those things was, well, you're not great on Europe either, and now there's a threat to our sovereignty or our neutrality, and is even kind of, you know, stoking this up. Of course, he wins this election just shy of a majority, but, you know, now he's faced with, I have to implement this. And of course, that lack of foresight in doing that, that greed, if you like, to get into power and to do as much damage as possible, and we see it all the time, we've seen it from other governments in later years as well, forces them into a position where they're then damaging government and what they've got to do. And this creates a real headache. Haughey wants to deal with the financial crisis in the country. He's got a massive task to do there. This now is a sudden distraction and not what he needs at all. Equally, though, you can sense, now we can all give out and we can all say, look at cheeky Europe, we're a sovereign independent country and we should have our right to say no to things, and of course you do, and whatever, right, that's all there. But equally, you can understand some of the frustration on Europe, because you got to see it from their side. All the countries have come together, they've been through this painful negotiation of decades of bringing the major powers together to do this deal, get us. They managed to get something down, they agree, and now they're putting it through. The Danes are getting it through, the Italians are getting it through. Everybody's got headaches getting this through, yes, because, you know, it's tough stuff. This is senior hurling, if you like. And they expect that. They expect, you know, look at this, we're reshaping all of history here. This isn't, you know, opening a bank account. this is something where you're going to be part of something that's changed world history. That's the kind of level we're at here. And they're looking at Ireland and going, oh, what do you mean? That the country we've helped since 1972 that came in and we've been actually helping out and is going to do well out of this, they're saying no, and they're going to block the whole damn project. That, you know, to them or to people in that situation, it was like, oh, for crying out loud, who let these guys in? You know, are you serious? They're going to block this entire project, the entire future of Europe put at risk because that one little island out there is now getting, you know, despite the fact that this is going to have huge benefits for us and has all given in to many of the things its governments have been demanding and negotiating for the best part of it, 10 years or more. And they get all that, and now they say, oh, actually, we have to have a referendum. This isn't going to be able to go through here. There might be an issue with passing it. There was anger. Whether the reports are you know, accurate and exactly what was said, but there was anger at this. Anyway, referendum has to happen. That's the important thing, and the government are confident we're going to get through this. Here's the interesting thing, though. In about the Single European Act, it doesn't become a lot about, we talk about the economic benefits, definitely. On the other side, this whole challenge to it is really about and comes back to the provisions on neutrality. Now, here's the thing. It is perhaps a little bit surprising that a country that's so economically obsessed and everything and hasn't really been part of the wars and stuff ends up being this big debate on neutrality and what neutrality means and how is this impacting our neutrality at this point. And that pertains a really big challenge for how the parties are going to react. Again, going back to Jane O'Mahony, Ireland's EU referendum experience, her paper, she says, quote, "The Single European Act referendum campaign is a case in point and set the tone on referendum campaigns to follow. While the Workers' Party and Sinn Féin campaigned for a no vote, the Labour Party did not adopt an official position due to internal differences, the main opposition came from groupings outside the party political system, including veteran EU campaigner Anthony Coughlan. Those campaigning for a yes vote argued that Ireland's membership of the European Community would be at stake and the damage done to the economy and employment if the referendum was defeated would be huge. Little effort was made to inform voters fully about the issues. In the end, the campaign was relatively short and the referendum was comfortably carried with an almost 70% yes vote. The fall in turnout to 44% was more alarming, however, and constituted at the time the second lowest ever turnout in a referendum. The effect of the low turnout was that the yes vote amounted to only 30.7% of the total electorate, compared with 58.4% in 1972. End quote. Now, that's a really important point here before just understanding what it was that had happened in that transfer period from 1972 up to 1987. Because the referendum here, the government's going to get over this comfortably. They're going to get that 70% endorsement of this referendum. But in dealing with the campaign and looking at what's happening here, first things first, we're going to get into a campaign that starts to stoke this neutrality question hugely for the political parties. And you're going to get these groups on the peripheries arguing for no votes, large body of collected opinion inside. Labour Party still can't really make up its mind. So all these years on, Labour's still a little bit not sure whether we're totally European or not, because it has some big voices opposing it within the party. And neutrality, again, is becoming the big issue for them. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, moving and shifting a little bit in terms of what they had said and what they believed and what their arguments were. All of these things mean that for these parties at this point, you're seeing them, these elites at the leaderships, if you like, want to get this through. But now they're forced into this conversation with people, and people don't really engage with it. And here's the problem in it. Like, you see, this was percentage wise, it looks like a ringing endorsement. But the truth is, what actually happens in this referendum, people just stay away. They're not interested in it. And here's the critical problem. for these kind of referendums. If people are just, we always assume that, you know, well, you know, maybe people didn't know enough about it and they stayed away. Maybe people did. Sometimes people just go, this isn't for me to decide. I don't want to make. This is why I pay my taxes and we pay politicians to take decisions. There's too much here. I am not reading your single European Act treaty or whatever other treaty. I'm not reading it. I'm not trying to sift through it. These guys say one thing and they're very intelligent people. These guys over here are very intelligent people too and they say a completely other thing. How am I meant to know? You know what? I'm staying at home. Let them figure it out. What happens, happens. That's the kind of thing that affects and infects a democracy in a referendum situation. This is a very complex debate. And, you know, it's a real danger for Ireland now that that's the outcome of it. People decide, you know what, kind of best thing perhaps here is to just stay away from it. Now, this idea of neutrality, though, does take over hugely in the argument. And Karen Devine, in her paper, Karen Devine, DCU, Parties, Attitudes Towards Neutrality and the ESDP, which is the section of dealing with neutrality. One of the things that this comes into is how the parties start to react. Karen Devine says, quote, 25 years ago, Patrick Keating in 1984 noted the futures posited by the European Community style of integration and by permanent neutrality are mutually exclusive. This incompatibility appears to be acknowledged in the Irish public's voting behaviour in referendums. Neutrality has been among the top substantive policy reasons for voting against successive treaties furthering defence and integration. E.g. the Single European Act, Maastricht Treaty, Amsterdam Treaty, Nice Treaty, Lisbon Treaty. Evidently, a proportion of Irish voters have consistently demonstrated a belief that further EU integration in the area of foreign security and defence policy is incompatible with the concept of neutrality that they support. End quote. Now, here's the real big problem for Ireland at this point. We've got into Europe. It's been a positive experience, etc., etc. It was one of these situations where, as far as they were concerned, they knew, you know, look, this is going to be great. It's going to be great for Ireland. It's going to be great for our economy. And the two main parties tend to be quite pragmatic about things. But of course, as this moves into a single market, there are other questions. Not only about the social policy that Ireland has been obsessed with, and we've been negotiating behind the scenes for well over a decade on these cohesion policies and, you know, what's needed for, you know, each of the regions to grow. On the other side of it, there will always be a question about security. What happens if we are attacked? You know, what happens in a situation where Europe is attacked? And then, you know, there's always this fear, there's always this thing that, you know, well, we don't want to be part of anything where we go out and invade anybody else. And that's an understandable position from Ireland, given its history. It never wants to be seen as an invader or anything like that, or support anyone in that. But it brings these other situations of, yeah, but it's not always as plain and simple as that. You know, what happens when conflicts happen on your doorstep, when you have to protect people? What happens if you're attacked? And be under no doubt that if Ireland somehow was invaded by somebody from somewhere, Ireland would be appealing to her European colleagues to come help her. That creates this kind of dynamic of, well, how does that work? Because there has to be some integration of security and defence. So this debate develops that these are mutually exclusive. Ireland's absolute neutrality, and we're not being we're being completely neutral, is different to a being part of a European project, where there's always going to have to be some pooling of some resources on security here. Now, problem, of course, is that many of the parties have not really thought out a position on neutrality. And to be honest with you, Ireland hasn't really figured out its neutrality yet. Because it's not like the Swiss and other countries who, you know, put in this hugely, deeply thought out where we're going and what we're being part of. We're not quite sure. We just know neutrality, particularly neutrality, was born out of a position in World War II. We're too fragile and too new to really be involved in a war here, and we don't want to be backing in with Britain anyway. So, you know, look, it's just too complex to stay out of it. And it did help Ireland in terms of its own protecting its own economy, although it damaged it internationally hugely in diplomatic terms. But all of that gave us this neutrality policy, which hasn't really been discussed in any great detail. Now, again, the political parties all have these issues with it. Again, going back to Karen Devine and what Haughey has done here and the problem he's given himself in her paper, Parties' Attitudes Towards Neutrality in the SDP, she says, quote, Fianna Fáil rejected the CFSP obligation to be bound to common positions in keeping with majority opinion because a common foreign policy is incompatible with our neutrality. Fianna Fáil also claimed that the Single European Act posed challenges to our neutrality, noting a persistent worrying tendency to try blur the lines of distinction between the community and the Western European alliance, and attempts to include military aspects of security in European political cooperation. On the basis that we have reached, perhaps gone beyond, what is strictly compatible with neutrality, Fianna Fáil demanded a declaration that the Single European Act does not and cannot affect our long-established policy of neutrality and does not affect Ireland's capacity to act or refrain from acting in any way affecting our status of neutrality. But back in government, 3 months later, the party supported the Single European Act and party leaders' discourse reverted to the former policy of military neutrality. End quote. Now, what Karen Devine points there to is this problem that Fianna Fáil created for itself in Haughey's all-out opposition, wrapped the green flag in neutrality round. Now, again, go back to 1972 and some of the quotes I took to you from Jack Lynch, former Fianna Fáil leader at that time, who believed that, of course, you know, we were thinking of some kind of cooperation at that point, and that there was a Fianna Fáil before this who was not at all done. And Fianna Fáil has tended to flip-flop on this neutrality issue, depending on, you know, what's, and we'll see it in later referendums too, because it never really defined what is neutrality, what is the kind of definition of it. It's been, we will be part of it sometimes, and then we won't be part of it other times. And sometimes we wrap this, and how he does this, he wraps this neutrality flag around himself in opposition. And then 3 months later, he's in government. Very foolish thing to do. But again, governments do it all the time. Of all parties, we see them, and we will see that in time to come. But those of you who remember we talking about the 2011 election will know that, you know, in that election, Fianna Fáil were long beaten, and Fine Gael and Labour could have made it very easy on themselves to be a popular government by taking their foot off the neck of Fianna Fáil and starting to agree to some of the issues that were there. But it wouldn't have given them as big a victory, so, you know, they didn't. And have to pay a price in government by being terribly unpopular for saying things that they could never deliver on. Equally, Fianna Fáil at this point does exactly that. Huh? He pushes and pushes and pushes. Now he has to go back on this stuff. And that creates a confusion in some voters' minds too. But Fianna Fáil flip-flops on this neutrality issue because trying to figure out when does it apply or when should it apply. On the other hand, you have Fine Gael. Karen Devine, again, in her paper, Party Attitudes Towards Neutrality in the EDSP, Karen Devine says, quote, under Fitzgerald, Fine Gael articulated a narrow concept of military neutrality, conceived in realist balance of power and Cold War contexts, meaning non-participation in a military alliance, not a member of NATO, WEU or any other alliance. This was primarily due to pressure from public opinion and because of staying outside of these military alliances allowed Ireland to play a more useful role in promoting world peace. As a foreign policy vehicle, military neutrality facilitated the positive merits of Irish foreign policy, UN peacekeeping, the 1961 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, decolonisation initiatives, opposing South African apartheid, accepting refugees, opposing US funding of South American paramilitaries, increasing aid to the Third World, and supporting Palestinian self-determination. End quote. So Fine Gael tried to deal with this, and they come up with this idea. Do you know what? Military. Now, Fine Gael have always been accused of being a little bit less sound, even again, than Fianna Fáil sometimes on neutrality, but probably because they kind of have a position, which is some within the party believe we should be part of a European army and should welcome that, and that there are, you know, that should be part and parcel of where we're at. There are some within Fine Gael who've articulated that position. But equally, some others have issues with it. And what Fine Gael in the 80s, around this time, they've come to a new policy, which is military neutrality. So it's okay not to be neutral on everything. We don't all have to be Switzerland. But military neutrality is different. We don't join a military alliance, but we do, of course, join certain things, because Fine Gael are coming to the realization that even just, you know, this thing of flying the flag and saying, well, it's okay to be part of the UN. The UN is in some ways a political force. Being part of the UN means you're already taking some kind of non-neutral stance. Being part of anything in it, unless you want to completely sit outside, then you have to have some new form of neutrality. So they settled that this is about military neutrality, not neutrality in a word on its own, military. We're not doing this in war and situations like that. That's how they're going to try overcome it. On the other hand, the Labour Party, they've all kinds of issues with it. Again, going back to Karen Devine and her paper, and she says, quote, "For the Labour Party, its version of neutrality was neither a pragmatic policy nor a refusal to join a military bloc, but a principled stance and active political philosophy that would always be relevant in a world of great power politics. This active neutrality, seen as a fundamentally held belief of Irish people, had an assertion of independence, implied a total commitment to peace. And the Labour Party positioned itself as having the longest and deepest commitment to neutrality. The party differed from Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in seeing neutrality as non-negotiable and wanting to ensure the EEC understood that Ireland would not give up neutrality for a common defence policy, placing it at the bottom left quadrant of the scale of, this is the quadrant that Karen Devine uses to place the positions. So this is places Labour in that quadrant that says they're most determined to protect neutrality. Quote, "Neutrality was the primary objective of Irish foreign policy over and above arriving at a common position or engaging in cooperation with other EEC members that might compromise, in particular, a neutral Irish position in relation to armaments, development and relations with the Third World. For Labour, Ireland neutral, positively pursuing its policy of neutrality at the United Nations and within the EEC, both at the Council of Ministers level and the technical level of European political cooperation, has a positive contribution to make if we have the guts to make it. The Labour Party further distinguished itself from larger parties by arguing that neutrality should be affirmed permanently by amendment of the Constitution. The issue of neutrality exemplified tensions in party-government relations arising from the process of Europeanisation, e.g., when in government, the Labour Party leadership supported ratification of the Single European Act, while the party's rank and file opposed it on the grounds that its provisions posed a threat to Irish neutrality. The party withstood the tensions, but later modified and clarified its position on Europe and EU foreign policy in ways which would minimise the potential for future difficulties. It was argued that participation in government and closer engagement with the EU, which this implied, effectively obliged the Labour Party to countenance and implement programmatic change." End quote. An important point here, because and Karen Devine points there too, is again, Labour was in this, as she says, she has this quadrant graph, which places the parties there in the lower quadrant, one of the ones he's absolutely, you know, defending Irish neutrality here. The problem here, though, is the more you're in government, the more, and we've seen this with other parties, Greens, others, you can oppose these things. The more you're in government, the more you're in contact with Europe, the more you have decisions you have to take, the more things are impacted where you're saying, this is our economy, this is all the other things, the jobs, the lives, the money, the social policy, your health policy, everything. Now, how much does neutrality matter? That you begin to ease on that and you begin to go, well, it's not exactly our neutrality we're losing. We're not giving it all up in one go here. So we can take a little step and we're okay. And that's what Europeanisation happens to parties in government, because they have to make progress on so many issues that they begin to adjust positions on some. It's a compromise that they have to reach. But of course, Labour doesn't take an official position in this referendum because it's too early for that. And that means they too get sidelined and they have half a party saying it's good and half party saying it's bad and all of that goes with it. But parties, when they're in government, are forced into decisions where they have to adapt positions, because while it might be absolute sense to stand up for neutrality, if the cost is and you've been told, listen, you're never going to be in a war here by accepting this, you'll still have to do X, Y and Z, but it maybe does bring you a little bit closer. So on a very theoretical level, maybe you're a bit less neutral after it. But you know, look, this is really about the jobs and the health services and the monies and the everything else that you want to solve. This is going to be part of it. you're inclined to go, come on, yeah, I can swallow this little bit of the pill, knowing I've still got something else to do to protect neutrality later. And that's where these, and this debate is going to go time and time again in Ireland. When we're faced with European referendums, neutrality is going to come up and time again as part of that. So that's where the main political parties are forced. Now, you still get the likes of Sinn Féin, others, these peripheral parties opposing it. But interestingly, the elites, if you like, the leadership, begin to pull back from this and they go, we don't want to be pushing this down people's necks. We don't want to be talking. We just want to tell them this is a good thing. We recommend it. And the opposition, the real opposition, comes from those who aren't in political parties, if you like, civic groups. And that becomes a hallmark of all future referendums too. So Crotty, Coughlin, people like that, they've brought this case. They've managed to win it. They've managed. Now they have a bit of a wind at their back. See, we told you can't trust these guys. They were going to try push this through if we hadn't challenged it. Now we have a protection there for people forever. And they see that as a major achievement. And it is from that point of view, because it makes sure they're going to stop at every point on the way when it comes to these negotiations. It's going to be a huge headache for governments in debating really complex issues and trying to get it all across to people in a narrow time frame. So once we're into the campaign, let's take a quick look. Again, thanks to my good friend Alan Kinsella on Twitter, at ElectionLit. Do take a look at his Twitter account. It's a great collection of literature. He has sent me on some of the stuff that was part of this referendum campaign, some of the literature. How what it looks like, one that jumps out at me is one from Labour, or if you like, a part of Labour, which is again, has different elements competing in this referendum because it doesn't take an official position. But it's a really impactful one. This is just a red and white leaflet. And in the background behind the writing is just a nuclear bomb exploding, the mushroom cloud, like familiar to people. And like at this time, you know, there's a lot of that thinking people in the world. And it just says, Labour believes that Ireland can play a constructive role in world affairs only by remaining neutral, and that Ireland can best oppose the arms race by working with other non-aligned countries for peace. Demand renegotiation. Vote no to NATO. That's the front page, and you see that. And here's one of these things that we're going to see time and time again. See that kind of clever line there, like, you know, it's a smart way of putting it. Vote no to NATO. It's not vote no to Europe. It's not vote no. Vote no to NATO. You know, and at a time, again, cast your mind back, 80s, 70s, the 80s, you know, World War and Cold War, all that still happening. You know, NATO wasn't something we wanted to be part of, and this is your chance now. Vote no to NATO. It says on the other side of the this from the Labour campaign for peace and neutrality. The Single European Act contains two treaties on deals with one deals with economic issues and the second one, called Title III, deals with foreign policy, security and defence. The Supreme Court found Title III to be unconstitutional. The effects of Title III will be 1. An end to neutrality. The aim of Title III is to achieve a common foreign policy among 12 EE states, and their positions must be in accordance with those of the NATO military alliance. 2. A weakening of Ireland's legal case against Sellafield's nuclear pollution. Under Title III, the EEC states pledge to maintain the technological and industrial conditions necessary for their security. This protects Sellafield, as that plant provides all of the reprocessed fuel for Britain's nuclear warheads and is thus deemed necessary for British security. 3. Ireland's independence in foreign affairs will be severely reduced. The Supreme Court argued that the Act restricts Ireland's freedom of action in foreign affairs. For example, Ireland may not be able to act independently in bodies such as the United Nations and the Council of Europe. The EEC and the Single European Act. The Labour campaign for peace and neutrality is not opposed to the EEC, nor is it against voluntary political cooperation. But the Irish people must oppose the EEC becoming the political arm of NATO military alliance in Europe. By voting no, Ireland will gain respect and strengthen its negotiating position in Europe. Vote no on May 26th. End quote there of that piece from the Labour campaign for peace and neutrality. And again here, and this is one of the things we're going to see time and time again. If you take those claims at face value, you would have to say none of them came true. And therefore, you could suggest, look, these guys are spoofing. They're telling you again all of this thing that it's an end to neutrality. Clearly, our neutrality didn't end. It remains a problem. We have this with every referendum ever since. The end thing is neutrality. So it didn't end. A weakening of the legal case against Sellafield. Yo, look where are we at now with Sellafield, and where are we at with Sellafield there. It's not really part of Britain's plans, been the closure, all of that kind of stuff. It's created problems. But ultimately, did the Single European Act do anything massively one way or another with this? No. Ireland's independence and foreign affairs seriously impacted. Positions on the Council of Europe or the United Nations, Ireland has certainly taken some, which at sometimes have been in opposition and sometimes in too much agreement or whatever, but we have acted in various different ways that could be considered independent. However, if you were the guy who wrote this, or the girl who wrote this, I don't know, they will probably tell you, yeah, but it wasn't about those things happening the minute you sign it. The fact is, we're on that road. The fact is that this maybe didn't end neutrality in one stroke, but it's been one little piece after another, and we're on the road still to do that. The same way as what was said in 1972 wasn't just out there. It just meant it's been slower happening, but it's happening. It's happening perhaps gradually in their eyes. And that independence and foreign affairs, well, how independent would we be if we weren't in any of this? We wouldn't have to worry about it. How many times have we maybe just tempered our positions because of what's going on in Europe? Therefore, now on the other side, people are going to say, but look, that's the price of having support and support from people. So that's what you're going to do. Now, there are so many others that we I'd like to touch on here, but just to take a couple of them, because there were some good ones. There was also a Christian civil rights. Now, as I say, you got to remember that a lot of the stuff that comes out from Europe, as I say, when it's in the opposition side, it comes out from these civic groups, one of whom is, you know, the likes of this particular one, Christian civil rights. Because the other issue, it doesn't take a massive one here, because neutrality takes centre stage, but the one that over the following years, neutrality is going to be in there, and it's always going to be lumped in too with abortion. And those two tend to go hand in hand with these European ones. So neutrality is a big one, and then we get an abortion bill to be coming in at this one. This document says, vote no May 26th to avoid losing our independence, to avoid a massive increase in the cost of living, to VAT on food, clothes, gas and electricity, to avoid losing our fundamental rights as citizens, including those of the unborn, to avoid losing CAP and crippling our family farms, to avoid losing the veto, our only safeguard, with only 3 votes out of 76, giving Europe absolute power over us in matters political, social, as it already has in economic matters, to avoid more job loss and even higher emigration. Can we be thrown out or victimised? No. Our rights are guaranteed by the Treaty of Rome. There can be no single European Act without Ireland. This leaves us in a strong bargaining position. Our freedom and independence are enshrined in our Constitution. Without it, we would have nothing. In 1972, we voted the following amendment to the Constitution, that no provision of this Constitution invalidates laws, acts done, or measures adopted by the state, necessitated by the obligation of membership of the communities, or prevents laws enacted, acts done, or measures adopted by the communities or institutions thereof from having the force of law in this state. The above clearly gives any decisions made by the EEC primacy over our constitution. Up to now, the above rights are limited to economic matters safeguarded by the veto. Unless we vote no, we give the EEC the same powers in matters political and social, and are under the heading of social cohesion, abortion and divorce may be forced upon us. Unless the primacy of our constitution is first restored, we give away all of our rights. End quote there from that document. And a couple of things to note here again. First of all, going back, sometimes some of this stuff has not moved on since 1972. They're still talking about a massive increase going to hit you in your VAT and your electricity and your prices. That was the stuff we saw in the previous referendum. Does it come true? Not particularly. Losing our independence, they're going to argue to you did, but other people can argue, look, nothing much changed really as regards for ordinary people seeing their independence. losing CAP and crippling family farms, I think, you know, your fair assessment would say that Europe actually ended up protecting many of those family farms for lots of years after. Even with reforms of CAP, it was still essential. Without it, it would have been worse. And, you know, this idea then that under social cohesion, what they're worried about is not the cohesion funds and the helping poorer states come up. They're actually saying social cohesion is going to be about abortion and divorce. That's what's going to come in here. And look, you can say, I think a fair assessment would say Irish society changed its opinions over the courses of the following 20 years through various experiences, rather than it being something forced from Europe that abortion or divorce would become part of this. It was very much something that was a decision taken within Ireland by a changing society itself. However, what they would argue here is that perhaps, and an interesting, I suppose, change in narrative is, they're not arguing here that as it might have been to go against being in the EEC. All of this, they're all saying now, well, look, we're not against the EEC. That's not a bad thing, okay, because they know the public has kind of liked it. But we're against the EEC changing in any way. So you've got to stop this. And our rights are protected. They can't kick us out. We're going to be fine. We'll actually be heroes. Everyone will love us for stopping this, so let's stop it. That's kind of the argument that the no side take at this point. Not we need out of Europe. It's more a case of we just need to stop Europe doing anything else and block these kind of changes. That's what they want and want people to say stick with the status quo. That's kind of the evidence, I suppose, from the no side. There is another one, which is from Christian Family Action in 1987. Interesting one because it follows some of the argument, but also has an interesting line in here. You'll see what I mean. It says, vote no. Avoid putting VAT on food, clothes, gas and electricity. Avoid losing CAP payments, thus crippling our farmers. Avoid losing the veto and having only 3 votes out of 76. Avoid making null and void the referendum on abortion and divorce. Single European Act is a sellout of our country and our constitution, which begins, in the name of the most holy Trinity, from whom is all authority and to whom as our final end. We vote for generations not yet born. To vote no means no change, the only safe vote. Vote no. End quote. You can see the Christian thing is strong in this and the message is strong, building on that fears of around that. But there's a clear fear that Europe is on two prongs. There's neutrality on one side and there's social change that we must resist on the other. And they see both of these things as being threatened by Europe. These strange Europeans, they don't have the same sets of values as us. And that's still very strong in the Ireland of this time. And their fears are very much to the fore. Now, on the other hand, Government Information Services at the time, the government at this stage, we'll cover this in later, and we're going to talk to some people about this in later referendums, but prior to what was called the McKenna judgment, government could spend its money on telling people to vote yes. Government can do that in later referendums, but at this stage you could, and the Government Information Services had 10 reasons why you should vote yes. 1, by approving the Single European Act, we guarantee Ireland's future in the EEC. 2, rejecting the act would mean turning our back on the most important economic partnership that Ireland has ever enjoyed and leave us isolated. 3, the act does not affect our neutrality. 4, it does not in any way affect the moral values and family rights enshrined in our constitution. 5, Ireland receives a net amount of 900 million annually from the community budget. 6, membership has brought many overseas firms here, which have provided 80,000 jobs so far. 7, the Act will open up full free access to a market of 320 million people for our products. 8, since we joined the community, it has provided £5.5 billion for Irish agriculture and given our farmers prices that in 1986 were twice as high as world prices. 9, the community has provided over £1.5 billion to develop our industry, roads, telecommunications and social programmes. 10, a no vote would bring economic disaster. Safeguard our future. Vote yes. end quote there from that piece. And interesting here on the yes side, a couple of things. First of all, going back to where we started out with Gareth Fitzgerald talking about us, we focus almost entirely on just the economic benefits here for you guys. Focus your idea on the money. We've got this. There's a lot of money coming in. There's the budget. There's no idealism behind this. There's no idealism of it being anything greater to be achieved. And maybe that's quite reasonable because maybe in a referendum, you're never going to get that view. You're never going to get that view across. So, but there's certainly not even in outside of referendum time, that kind of discussion going on. You also see a double-edged thing here, which was hallmark of all yes campaigns from this point on, which will say, here's all the money, here's all the jobs, here's all the good stuff Europe is doing. Now, do not vote no. If you vote no, economic disaster will ensue. And that threat side of it, that begins to weaken over time. We'll discuss that in its own, but it begins to weaken as people begin to doubt how much economic disaster. And we actually see that with Brexit too in their referendum. So it's an interesting point, but it is there at this point as something that people actually believe or actually think it would happen. So other parties and people, back the referendum, but it's mostly led by those people saying, you know, look, we're really opposed to it. Ultimately, you know, that's what the debate becomes about here. One side saying, look, keep to the programme. The other side saying, you're actually selling out the country. Neutrality, abortion, divorce. These are the diabolical trinity that are going to destroy us. Be careful. Ultimately, we get to a referendum whereby the result is, and now, as was pointed out earlier, one of the difficulties here, the yes vote's nearly 70%, 69.92%. So it's a massive endorsement in percentage-wise. However, the turnout is only 44%, which is low at this point, one of the lowest. And it does point to one thing which is probably not appreciated by the political figures at this time. Something's going wrong here. Something's going wrong with how people engage with this European topic. For that amount of people, considering so many turned out and wanted to be part of it, what it shows here is a real start of a disengagement with this European process. And it's largely because these topics are really, really difficult. We do care, and you have a state who does care about things like neutrality, but it's complicated. Divorce, but it's complicated. Abortion, but it's complicated. And on the other hand, of course, we just want the money and the good economy and the jobs and the lives. And I don't know. And we are getting voters increasingly at this who begin to look and go, how can you expect me to make this decision? Of those that do vote, though, they have a very strong opinion on it. In glancing at I give you a sense of some of the constituencies, you're looking at Carlo Kilkenny, 72% yes. Cavan Monaghan, 79% yes. They are huge votes right around the country. Some of the biggest ones, Galway East, 83% yes. Limerick West, 80.6% yes. Mayo East, 82% yes. Mayo West, 80.7% yes. Roscommon, 80% yes. Sligo Leitrim, 75.5% yes. Longford Westmead, 76.6% yes. Big votes right around the country. Now, there were some where that vote dropped. Some of the biggest votes were the, say, Cork North Central had a 45% no, 54% yes. Dublin Central, 41.9% no, 58.1% yes. Dublin North West, 45.6% no, 54.4% yes. You go down through some of those, and they're probably some of the ones. You go into Dublin West, 61.5% yes, 38.5% no. So, comprehensive enough victory. There is perhaps a small pattern, though you're dealing with very small numbers to be really predicting patterns here. Urban areas, again, Cork City, Dublin City, finding a doubt about maybe Europe. The surprising thing there, I suppose, look, just to throw an interesting question out here that we will look at in future referendums, what's driving that? Because some of the no literature I'm reading to you, I'm saying to you there's this diabolical trinity of issues that are always going to come up in Europe. Neutrality, abortion, divorce. Yet, in many of those urban constituencies, abortion and divorce are not necessarily the ones that are, when we come to those referendums, that's where you maybe find a stronger ground for support of those things happening. Whereas you're looking at some of the rural constituencies there with huge yes votes for backing this, are some of the constituencies that are the most worried about abortion and divorce coming in. But clearly, perhaps those rural constituencies are not as worried about neutrality as neutrality is maybe a big issue in Dublin or Cork. And maybe it's just an urban disaffection with things. Maybe there's just more of a sense of being disaffected, or maybe groups that are opposed to it in certain parties or in urban parties, Labour Party, Sinn Féin, maybe they just have a stronger base in urban areas to actually get out and campaign, whereas in rural areas, many of them are still the big parties like Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael at this stage who control the agenda. Either way, it's a comprehensive victory. What it does point to, though, is that Charles Haughey, as Taoiseach, can implement the Single European Act, and things are going to change from that point on. What is going to happen, too, is Ireland is going to change a little bit, because first thing for government comes about these negotiations on what becomes known as the Delors Funds, Delors 1 and Delors 2. That's these cohesion funds. They're really important. And they're going to have a massive impact in Ireland. But they're a painful negotiation process that has to be gone through. That is going to change it. Something else also changes, though, too. And we noted this in other campaigns where we talked about this in the election series. But Europe is now on the agenda. Because we've had to have this referendum, the positive thing out of it is that up until this point, even in the 1987 election, there hadn't been much talk about Europe. There hadn't been much debate about Europe. Now we've had this referendum. Every party manifesto from there on in, the next election will be in 89, and from there on in starts to include big sections on Europe and what's happening in Europe and their views on Europe. Therefore, it does change how parties interact with the European question from that moment on. And so that's where we have to leave this particular referendum, but an important one because it changes not only the content of the treaty of the Single European Act, the content of it changes Ireland, it changes Europe, it changes how Europe interacts on the world stage, it changes everything. And Ireland has played a big role in the formulation of it, and now has had a big role in actually getting this passed and going up because of a fear that maybe we would have held it up, didn't transpire, and now all is good. Harmony rules and Europe progresses. But imagine if it had gone the other way. There would have been big questions asked. However, it does shape European politics right across the continent for the next 20 years. And what we have today, very much on the world stage, is affected by decisions taken at that time in the Single European Act. So Ireland had its own debate. Ireland had its own discussion. Ireland is now on to a series of European referendums that have to be considered. We're going to look at many of those in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, I hope you have enjoyed this podcast. If you have, please give me a shout out. Spread the word about it. Let your friends, people know, anybody you think might be interested. Give it an old recommendation if you like it. Give us a shout out on Twitter at Johnny Fallon, at JonnyFallon. If you have any thoughts, theories, ideas, anything you'd like to suggest. And of course, if you give it a shout out to let others know that it's still here and maybe you like what we're doing. We will be returning in the future now for more referendums and what all that brings, both on social issues and of course on European issues and the impact they have had. But that's it for now. My thanks again to Alan Kinsella for the election literature, my colleagues in Car Communications for their input, support and advice, and of course to Car Communications Library Access, which is invaluable for a podcast like this, and we will be back soon. So in the meantime, stay safe out there, and we'll talk again soon.